Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is season 2, episode 1. Thank you for listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoy, the director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, in season 2, I am going to talk to Dr. Caroline Heffernan, who's an assistant professor at Temple University in Sport and Recreation Management. Welcome, Dr. Heffernan.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Lavoy.
I have been pestering Dr. Heffernan, easy for me to say, to join me on this podcast since the very beginning, but she is very busy being a new assistant professor at Temple. So she has kindly agreed to talk to us about her groundbreaking, dare I say, research on gender allyship. And so we're going to have her sort of outline what this is, talk a little bit about her dissertation work around gender allyship and what she found and what we can all learn and what we can actually do with this. Because when I'm out in the community doing workshops with sports stakeholders, really around the globe, allyship is top of mind for everybody. And everybody's looking for information that's evidence-based to help them actually do something to create systems change, specifically in my realm for girls and women in sport. So I'm super excited to dig in. So, Dr. Heffernan, why don't you just start with telling our listeners what is allyship and what is specifically is gender allyship?
Yeah, so I think allyship is a term that has come into prominence within the past sort of 4 years, but it's really has its roots back to civil rights movement, back to like women's suffrage, and even going back to thinking about getting Black people the right to vote. And so what allyship is really how people who are of privileged classes or even other minority classes can unite to create social change. And depending upon the various needs and timing in history, the focus of the allyship has been different, like I said, voting. But I think allyship hasn't been talked about within an organization up until sort of recently. And thinking about allyship within an organization is a unique way to think about how we can take this framework that has created social change and think about ways to create organizational change as well.
Yeah, so how did you land on this concept of gender allyship? And how is that different from other forms of allyship that we might think of, LGBTQ allyship or other forms? So walk us through what gender allyship is.
Yeah, so I sort of approach this topic from a combination of academic and personal approaches. I am a queer woman, and I sort of saw the success and buy-in of the straight community towards the marriage equality push of the, early 2010s. And that happened sort of concurrently while I had started my doctoral work at the University of Minnesota. And I was reading a lot of articles about sort of how men are the problem, men are the barrier, and all these different sort of novel ways to approach ways to increase women in leadership, increase women's presence in sport. And so I had this sort of profound personal experience and this really frustrating academic experience. And around that same time, Greg Popovich hired Becky Hammon to be the first female assistant coach of a men's professional team. And I really sort of looked at that through the lens of what has happened in my own personal life and thought about, well, that's just allyship around gender. And doing more research, again, I was mostly familiar with allyship from a queer perspective, but it has its roots in the civil rights movement, where white people were aligning themselves with the civil rights struggle and sort of amplifying the voices of Black people. And I really, when I was looking at all these articles about allyship, it said it can be applied to any socially constructed category, of which gender is one. And there wasn't any data that talked about allyship as applied to gender. And so rather than just saying this is allyship, we talked about as gender allyship to see if it is something uniquely different. And then ultimately, was it more of the same approach? So gender allyship is allyship as applied to gender. That's really the only distinction. And it sort of came from a bit of a cautious and intentional approach of where this is sort of its first foray of understanding how allyship could be applied to gender.
Yeah, I remember back when you were first conceptualizing this and digging into the reading, and we kept having conversations about, you know, does this literature exist somewhere? Am I missing it? Or is this some novel, groundbreaking thinking? And it turns out to be the latter, that you're really onto something here. And since you started thinking about this, you know, talk about allyship has just exploded. And which is really exciting because you've been on the forefront of this idea of gender allyship. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about how allyship is different from mentorship, which is different from sponsorship, because a lot of times these get used and conflated together. And, you know, my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is, you know, a mentor doesn't have to be in your organization and sort of talks with you about personal and career success. A sponsor is usually within the organization and leverages his or her capital within the organization to help people get to the next level. But an ally seems different than sponsor. So what is your thought on that? Because I have a thought, but I don't know if it's right or not.
So I think what differentiates allyship from mentorship and sponsorship, I think, is the acute awareness of the problem that you're trying to address and your potential to help work to remedy a solution. And that, to me, is truly the distinction. And depending upon who you are, what level you are in your organization, you may have more or less power, formal power, but you might have more of a relationship power, a relational power. And so recognizing the ways that we all have influence, I think is truly what will separate an ally. So it's recognizing your influence and then using that influence strategically, intentionally to affect some type of organizational change and increasing the number of women you see in your organization and increasing the number of women in leadership positions specifically, because that's what I particularly focused on. But it can be applied, thinking about how can you use this awareness that you have to leverage that and advocate for not just a particular person or a particular individual, but we need to be considering this broadly and thinking about the ways that our systems, our structures have actually excluded people from whatever group, women, people of color, queer people, systemically, and how can we actually address that? So it's sort of taking a introspective approach, but then also an approach to see who am I in my organization and how can I leverage my own power.
Right. So an ally differs from sponsored. An ally seems to have an awareness of their own power within the system and are explicitly trying to combat systemic oppression and strive for systems change. So it's more equitable in this case for women. And I like the way that you think about that men are part of the solution. Men are, they can also be the problem, and that's well documented. We know a lot about that. But I like the shift recently that you're leading, that men are part of the solution. It's like basic physics, right? An equal and opposite reaction. It can't just be the women fighting for systemic change. We need the men, and we need the men to be allies, explicit allies, and not just what I like to call pretenders or wannabes, you know, like, you know, the women's rights and women in positions of power are great, but they don't actually do anything. They're not actively against it, although there are some that are, but that they're actively helping change the system while helping individuals in the system. Would that be about right?
Yeah, I think conceptual, like it all comes back to that foundational definition of allyship. It's people within positions of power or other minority groups aligning. And so it's that alignment of this is how we're going to create social change. To be perfectly frank, men have a lot more power within sport and rec than women have. They've had, you know, 100 years of established presence in specifically the competitive side of sport compared to women. And, you know, if we're going to create long-term change, it's going to come because of a collaboration between the two. I think if we even look at last week's WNBA CBA, which is historic, the WNBA's historic deal is facilitated by the fact that it is an NBA organization. I am not under any false pretenses that the WNBA could not have probably been as successful as it currently is without the backing of David Stern and Adam Silver. They have both been incredible allies for the increased integration of the WNBA into the NBA properties. And is the WNBA perfect? Absolutely not. Could the NBA be a better partner? Absolutely. But they have 20 almost a quarter century of documented support of women's sports. And that is what separates the WNBA from the NWSL, from the National Women's Hockey League, from the Fast Pitch Professional League. Like, it's what separates them. It's the backer. And it's that form of allyship.
I like I saw a lot on social media calling out specifically the influence and the allyship of David Stern in the success and longevity of the WNBA. And I think the more we call that out, then it maybe invites more men in to be part of the solution. And for those men who are already allies, to acknowledge them. But for those on the margin or who are afraid to be an ally or don't know how to be, or they don't know the right language, or, you know, I hear a lot, well, I'm a lot of fear in this Me Too era of men trying to be the white knight that saves everything, because so many men have acted badly in occupational contexts, that a lot of men just, they want to help, they don't know what to do. So what did you find? Well, before we get to some sort of what can we do, just briefly, without taking a deep dive into methods like we like to do as academics, what did you do? Who did you interview? And then we'll segue, I'll ask you about what did you find. So, you know, just for the listeners, top level, what did you do for your dissertation?
So I did a qualitative study. The particular methods, for anyone interesting, is a grounded theory study. And the reasoning behind that is when you don't have data and you don't have a theory to go from, you need to sort of build from what you have. And so in the absence of data, which is understanding how men can be part of the solution and how women are also part of the solution, we had to sort of take this qualitative grounded theory approach. And so I did interviews with, at the start, only men in the sport industry. And I looked at men who were in professional organizations, intercollegiate sport organizations, nonprofit, and sport media. And so the reason and rationale behind looking at the breadth is allies operate in unique ways depending upon where they fall in their organizational change, or chain, and where they, what part of the industry they are in. Because an intercollegiate Division III school is not going to have the same resources as someone who works in sport media or a professional sport organization. And so from that initial sort of fact finding, we also sort of said we need to find out how women feel about allyship and how are women acting as allies. And so it sort of evolved into this broad study that looked at allyship in its different forms by both men and women, and the ways that women sort of help build men along to be allies, and how also men build each other up and sort of help instruct them in the importance of gender equity within a sport context.
Yeah, and I liked the way that you followed the data that led you to also interview women. Because I think the assumption when we're talking about allyship, that gender allies are only men. And I hear often, as do many of our listeners, that women with positions of power in sport are oftentimes other women's worst enemy and do not bring other women along, which is another blame the woman narrative. So I like the fact that you include women in this, because we need women with power to be gender allies too for other women. So, you know, what do you have to add to that in terms of why more women?
Well, I think a lot of that came from the men, of just being like, we don't know what it's like to be a woman in any part of society, let alone sport. And even the men who had grown up alongside seeing women and girls participate in sport, they still never knew what that experience was. And so, and this is very akin in how it relates to the more broad paradigm of allyship, is, you know, the people, the minority, that the more members of the minority group set the agenda, and they say, this is what we need, this is sort of the next peace and battle. And so then it's the responsibility of the other groups, the majority members and the other minority members, to respond. And it's really, they set the tone and tenor, and then other people are leveraging their power because they might have more of it. So the women know what it's like. They know what needs to be addressed in the organization. The men are then able to then amplify that voice and then take that perspective into a space where women aren't present for whatever reason. It could be positional, it could be by accident, in quotes, for whatever reason, women are excluded, and there are a lot of other justifications for why that happens. But it's, how can allies be present so that while there may not, if there is a situation where a woman is not in the room, how can they represent that perspective?
Yeah, and there's been a lot of talk in the business literature as well about this idea of amplification and repeating what a woman says and helping women lean into the table, right? And that's not just about women leaning in, but it's about men leaning out, and, you know, all these sort of metaphors for power within organizations. So to wrap this up, what were like the top three nuggets that you took away that people can learn from and what they can do that came out of your data to be better allies or to advocate for allyship within their organizations? Give us the top level findings.
Well, I want to say one other thing about what you just said, and then I'll get into the things that people can do. I really just think it comes down to whether or not we're leaning in or leaning out. I think it's thinking about this as a team. And if we're trying to create structural change around gender access or gender representation, our star players, the people who are going to make our team successful, are going to be women. But we're not going to be able to have a successful team without effective role players. Like, this is teamwork basic. I think trying to frame it in that level, particularly in sport, is a really accessible way to get people on board. Like, we all know what makes a successful team. We all know why a basketball team is successful. They have one or two or three really great players, and then the rest of the people on that team have a role to fill, and they do that role expertly. Like, it's about managing your team, finding your voices, finding the people who are going to set the agenda, who are the women in this situation, and then finding the right role players.
I love that analogy. Listeners, you heard it here first on Tucker Center Talks. Although I'm sure Dr. Heffernan has been talking about this in other places, we're documenting it here. Teamwork, team analogy.
Teamwork, it makes the dream work.
It's exactly the same. Okay, so what can we do? Give us three concrete strategies for being an ally or creating allies in sport.
So I think the first thing that you need to do, regardless, man, woman, non-binary, wherever you may fall on the gender spectrum, you need to sort of sit with yourself. I think the crucial piece for all of this, and the thing that separated an ally from someone who was otherwise what I called interested but concerned, who might be those people who are afraid of me too, is sort of a check-in with yourself. Like, what makes you, like, do you have a form of privilege? How can you potentially leverage that form of privilege to help? Is that something you're comfortable with? Why is that something you're not uncomfortable with? So I think it really requires a deep sense of check-in, because someone's self-awareness into who they are and why they really are passionate about this issue is really what's going to separate them from someone who's going to be an ally versus someone who might classify themselves as an in name only. Because if you're not willing to actually say some things that might get people unhappy with you, you're probably not going to be an ally. You're going to make some people uncomfortable, but you have to be willing to know that you're doing this because there's a reason, and it's because you feel that this is what's right. So the individual piece is going to be where it starts for everyone.
Okay, so number one, individuals have to be self-aware.
Self-aware.
And be able to do the hard work, which starts with acknowledging their own privilege.
Yes.
And it's interesting because I just got asked to do a talk to a group of athletic administrators. I won't say where, what level. But in my title of my talk was how to develop and support and be a better ally for women in sport. And the director of the conference was very uncomfortable with my title because of allyship, mm-hmm. and wanted me to change the title. And I said, no, I will not change the title. This is precisely why you invited me to come. If the word ally makes you uncomfortable, you've got a lot of work to do. And it sort of made me reinforce the work that we're doing in this space. So self-awareness, number one. Okay, number two.
I also think it sort of comes down to, we need to create cultures that value and retain women. Because ultimately, we can't increase women's representation in sport if we keep losing them. Like, we can't keep hiring to replace them. So retention is going to be the best sort of solution and ultimately attract more women. So I think it's figuring out ways that you can identify the men who are allies and or in that interested and concerned piece. I think those are sort of the bigger takeaways in figuring out ways that you can leverage the male allies that you do have to have an informed conversation and have some type of like mentorship about the importance of equity, or why does this actually matter for us? Because I think there's a lot of talk about why diversity matters. And I honestly think a lot of people are afraid to say, well, why does it matter? Like, they know it matters, but we don't really know why. Well, we're trying to respond to a more diverse, or we have a more diverse customer base. If we're only represented by people who look one particular way in a room, we're not going to attract a diverse customer base. Like, that from a sport management perspective, that's how I tell my students who I want to work in pro sport. This is why we need a diverse team base. It's because not everyone's going to respond to the same things that you do. So I think helping them understand the why really gets a lot of people on board, and then helps with some of the self-awareness piece. So I think that idea of finding your male allies and then identifying that interested but concerned group and figuring out ways to sort of like breadcrumb them along. How can you get them on this process so that they're starting to feel more comfortable using their voice? Because ultimately the next sort of second step is using your voice and figuring out people and surrounding yourself with a group that you feel comfortable with. Because being in spaces where you feel like what you're going to say is going to fall on deaf ears, that even the most self-aware and driven ally, that becomes frustrating. So figuring out ways and spaces that you can feel like you're having an impact, and that might not always be your boss, but it might be someone else within your organization who you know that when you go into this meeting, that you guys are going to have each other's back. And I think figuring out ways, who can you work with intentionally and collaboratively, because again, teamwork makes the dream work, is really going to be the ways you can create small changes that it's not going to create a culture overnight that suddenly values women, but you're going to be advancing it ever so slightly. And social change is not ever a windfall. It's those small incremental pieces. And that's what makes it really frustrating, because it's not going to be, you know, the big swing. Like, it's taken 5 years since Becky Hammon was hired for there to be a female hired in MLB. We have a lot of women in assistant coaching positions in basketball now, and that's because Greg Popovich was the first person and he's successful.
Yeah, what are we up to, 11 now?
Yeah, it's just about like a third of the teams.
Yeah?
A third.
Amazing.
In 5 years.
That's pretty fast.
It's fast, but really a lot of those have come within the past 2 years. For a while, it was just Becky. I would say probably for a year and a half, because they wanted to sort of see how it went.
Now we'll see, to your point, is about the team and retaining talent, right? Which was part of your you can't just keep losing your talent and having them go in the transfer portal.
Right.
You need to keep them, right? Because that's economy of scale. So, all right, number three, to bring it home, what is the third thing people can do around allyship that we should know about?
I think it's recognizing and celebrating the ways that women are leaders, because I think that actively goes against the reasons and the justifications for why women can't be in leadership positions. So the fact that, you know, the Spurs have been so successful over a course of, you know, 20 years, but even in the past five, that is a reason. And when Becky Hammon won the Summer League, that's women being successful, demonstrating the fact that her gender has no impact on her ability to perform that job, because it actively goes against the justification.
Right. And because we're ramping up to the 2020 Super Bowl, let's not forget Katie Sowers.
Katie Sowers, yep.
First out lesbian assistant football coach in the NFL for the Super Bowl contending San Francisco 49ers.
Yeah.
5 years from now, maybe we'll have 12 women assistant coaches in the NFL.
Yeah, and thinking about that is an incredible success that we've had, and that celebration is important. And we're really lucky that we're seeing that celebration, and the fact that her success as an assistant coach is not dictated by her gender. How does that actually mean and create windfall throughout the rest of the NFL and throughout the NCAA?
Well, that's a whole different beast.
Well, yes, but success at the top levels is ultimately what says, oh, well, maybe women can coach, or maybe women can be whatever. And so seeing it in these prominent positions, hopefully you get then enough people who are buying it, and you say you have an ally who is willing and capable of taking that risk. He feels comfortable enough, or she feels comfortable enough, because another important piece is no one's going to make a decision that's going to jeopardize their career. And so some people may think it's the right thing for them to do, but they don't necessarily feel like they're in the position to do that. So unfortunately, it comes a little bit down to the timing and their assessment of the where your organization is and whether or not they're capable of supporting that woman in a new prominent position. And that's the unfortunate part of this.
I'm hoping there'll be a trickle down, right? So we're talking about these women, visible coaches at the professional level. And ironically, pro men's sport is leading the charge for creating visibility for women coaches, which is a little bananas in a way, but also good bananas.
That is, but that's also the majority of the professional sport world. So if we're not going to create change there, we're not going to create change in the professional sport world.
But most of the, I mean, yes, there's a limited range of professional coaches.
Yeah.
More coaches in the NCAA. And my, you know, question for future podcasts is, why is the professional level leading? And is there really going to be a trickle-down effect to the NCAA? Because you would think it would be the opposite. And it, in fact, we'll know over time if this, in fact, is happening or not. And we will be watching.
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to the nature of the organizations. Like, professional sport leagues are private organizations, and they have the ability to be a little bit more nimble, and they have oftentimes a lot more capital at their disposal to, you know, respond to social trends. If they see the success or the fact that people are liking when we're hiring more women, so we can, you know, the next time we hire, we have more resources to devote to a potential female hire and provide them with things like maternity care and other pieces that we're not used to providing for our other male coaches. So I think the resource piece, and when we're dealing with mostly, you know, underfunded athletic departments who are relying on their institutions as well, because the majority of athletic departments aren't creating or aren't in the black, like, they don't have the same financial resources. And I think that's a huge piece. And then also just like their constituent bases are different. They have more alumni and they have to do a lot more placating their stakeholders, whereas the other, like, the professional sports are a business, period of a sentence, and they make that very clear. And so I think that framing businesses versus education means that worse on the education side, we are always slower to respond.
Yes, and those of us in the academy know things happen very slowly over time. Well, that's just something, and I've been thinking of, and, you know, I know a lot of the listeners are also thinking about this, and I really appreciate your thoughts on allyship, your strategies for change, the individual, the cultural, and just celebrating women coaches are women leaders in sport. And we will be very excited when we see your work in publication and that we can all cite it profusely and give you the credit that you so deserve. So thank you, Dr. Heffernan, for being on the first episode of season 2 of Tucker Center Talks.
Thank you for having me.
Voice of women in sport.
So to wrap it up today for season 2, episode 1, I'd love to hear from you. So tweet us at Tucker Center or at WIS Sports or to me directly at Dr. Sports Psych. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Instagram. And you can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wispsports.com. And look for the Tucker Center Talks tab, where you'll find a lot more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for episode 1 of season 2 of Tucker Center Talks. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.